The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Over the past few months, you will have heard us and other podcasts and radio stations discussing the takeover of Newcastle United. You will have heard journalists discussing human rights abuses, but you might not have heard a more personal account. Today, with the help of the journalists at Josimar, we hear from someone whose sister is in prison in Saudi Arabia for, amongst other charges, driving a car, and we hear what she has experienced. Also today, we will try and take a step back and discuss why Saudi Arabia is the latest Gulf state to try and get involved in football ownership. What is soft power? Does it work? Should anyone be allowed to own a football club? Should football clubs be held to a higher moral account than other businesses? And do fans have any power in any of this? This is the Guardian Football Weekly. Joining me for this is Philippe Auclair. Philippe, lovely to see you as always. Now, this idea came around because you rang me up, basically.
Yes, basically. I think we've been talking about football politics for a long time. My FIFA rants have become a feature of my interventions. But I thought, and you thought too, that we didn't quite have the time to present the problems, the political problems and human rights problems which surround football in enough depth, and also that we were a bit too bitty, that we needed to present sometimes the bigger picture. And so maybe to devote a whole podcast to the big issues and the big picture of football politics and football governance. And this is how, you know, we started to talk and how The Guardian and, in this case, Josimar have teamed up for this particular program. So maybe, do you want me to say a bit more about Josimar?
Yeah. Tell us who they are.
Well, Josimar is a Norwegian magazine, which has acquired quite a reputation, I think, worldwide. They also publish in English for their investigative work and their work on football governance for a number of years. And they've been responsible for some big stories. For example, they've been covering African football politics in incredible depth with Paul Hodoyard. They've been also interested in the financial affairs of some football agents. And I've worked with them now for 3-4 years. And there's a kind of synergy that was born there, because what we were looking at with Josimar was also very much the kind of thing that, you know, we wanted to talk about together on The Guardian Football Weekly. So that's what we're doing now.
That's exactly what we're doing now. We're going to start by talking about Saudi Arabia. Obviously, their private investment fund tried to buy Newcastle United. We felt it was really important to hear from someone who is much closer to the human rights issues than just more journalists saying the human rights are bad in that country. Lina Al-Hathloul's sister, Lujain, was one of several activists who, following arrest in 2018, was reportedly subject to abuse at the hands of the Saudi prison system. According to three separate testimonies obtained by Amnesty International, the activists were repeatedly tortured by electrocution, flogging and sexual assault. Saudi officials have denied those allegations and that any form of torture has taken place. Philippe and I caught up with Lina last week. This is our interview. So, Lina, welcome to Football Weekly. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think it's really important to hear your story and your sister's story. And I think a lot of listeners will want to hear it as well, even though it's a difficult one, and perhaps precisely because it is a difficult one. Your sister, Lujain, is in jail. Can you tell us why and what's happened to her?
So my sister Lujain was one of the main campaigners for a woman to drive in Saudi Arabia. She got arrested the first time in 2014 and then she got arrested again in 2018. But since her arrest in 2018, she's still in jail. She has never been judged, and we don't have any news of Lujain. So she was one of the main activists in Saudi Arabia who would campaign with her name and with her picture also. She was known as one of the leaders of the feminist movement as well, because she wanted to open a shelter for women who are victims of domestic violence. And so since she really began her campaign and her activism, Lujain has been targeted a lot of times by the Saudi regime. But it's never been as bad as this time.
I've seen you speaking sort of very eloquently and bravely about what your sister's endured. I found it quite hard to listen to. How hard do you find it to to talk about it?
I mean, it's always very difficult to speak about it, especially when I have to talk about the torture she has endured. I've never seen her, but as my parents explain it, they have seen her shaking and having red marks on her skin because she's been electrocuted and flogged and waterboarded. But as I always say, silence did not help us. When we were silent, she was being tortured. And also people disappear in Saudi prisons. There are thousands of political prisoners in prison. And only the ones whose families are abroad are basically have minimum rights. And so I really think it's important to campaign for her so that she doesn't disappear in a Saudi prison. And that's also... hopefully she'll get released soon.
How are your parents?
I mean, my parents are very strong. They're always very hopeful for a better future. But, you know, it's becoming a bit tiring for us, especially that Rujain has not called for 2 months and we have no idea where she is now.
So she was campaigning for women to be able to drive in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, it was made, quite a big deal was made of the fact that it was made legal that women could drive. So then do we know why she was arrested?
So when she got arrested, she was in prison without charges for 10 months. And then the trial started and she found out about her charges in front of the judge. And basically all of her charges are her activism. So they accuse her of being in contact with foreign journalists, being in contact with foreign diplomats, which one of them is a UK diplomat. They accuse her of participating to international conferences to talk about the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. So every time they say that she's a traitor or that she's a foreign agent, the charges don't even say that. So there's really a narrative that's going on that is lying basically about who Lujain is.
I saw a video that you did. You were speaking at a conference, I think, where you said that she couldn't hold a pen when your parents saw her, but she tried to, she almost tried to suggest to your parents that she was okay.
Yes, so the first time they saw her was months after she was arrested. And during these months where my parents weren't allowed to see her, she was put in an unofficial prison where she was being tortured. And once my parents saw her, they saw that she could barely walk when she arrived to see them. They could barely recognize her. And when she was trying to sit, all her body was really hurting her. And after talking for a few minutes, she wanted to drink and she could barely hold the glass because she was shaking. After the Khashoggi murder, there was many leaks in the media regarding the torture. And so when my parents read that and visited her 3 months after, they told her, listen, Lujain, now you have to tell us that you were tortured and, you know, you're the only one that can save yourself because if no one knows about it, we can't do anything. And so Lujain told them all the details. She was really scared of telling them because one of the people who was torturing her and who was present and ordering the torture was Saud al-Qahtani, who's MBS's advisor. So it was, you know, very shocking and scary for her to give all the details, knowing that this man was still in power.
When you make accusations like this, how do the Saudi government react?
They have been ignoring us since the beginning. So, once we were really loud and public about the torture, the Human Rights Commission visited Lujain. And you have to know that no one was allowed to visit Lujain. So when we were asking for independent parties to come and visit Lujain to witness the torture, they never accepted this. But the Human Rights Commission, which is a Saudi government body, was allowed to visit Lujain. And Lujain told my parents that she felt betrayed of their visits, because she told them everything that had happened to her, from the sexual harassment to the electrocution, everything. And she told them that Saud al-Qahtani was there. And they were writing down everything. And then at the end of their conversation, Lujain asked them, can you assure me that you'll protect me with everything I've told you? And they really replied to her. They said, of course we can't protect you.
Lina, I mean, obviously, you know, we are a football politics podcast, but we're still a football podcast. And obviously there's, you know, as Maxen has been saying, there is a huge jump from such a story as the one you're telling us right now. And what is happening, what nearly happened in England, where the Saudi investment, you know, sovereign fund, was wanting to buy one of the country's most famous clubs, really, Newcastle United. And it's basically, how do you yourself feel when you hear about that? And also, how do you feel when you see that many people who were keen for the takeover to take place started to actually say that, well, actually the situation in Saudi Arabia is not that bad. In fact, the Crown Prince has tried to be a reformer. Women's rights are much better than it used to be. We should encourage, in fact, the dialogue with Saudi Arabia. We should cooperate with Saudi Arabia to encourage the reform process. How does that make you feel yourself?
I mean, I think both are really linked. I mean, Saudi Arabia's image internationally has been badly tarnished with its horrendous crimes and all its human rights violations. My sister's torture is one of them. And of course, they need to change their image. And one of the ways to do it is to be legitimate and to have soft power internationally. And football is now one of the best ways to do it. And I think it's a way of being legitimate in the international scene. But what Newcastle fans have to understand is that it's not any investment fund that's buying it. It's really the Saudi regime that's buying it. And the same regime that has tortured my sister and 100 of other activists, it's the same regime that's killing and making disappear the journalists, whether it's in the country or outside of the country. And I think that they have to understand they have leverage over the decisions of their club. It's good that it didn't happen for them and for us as well.
What was the reaction in Saudi Arabia when the news broke that the takeover would not take place in the end? And among the people who are part of the human rights movement there, was it something they thought was a good thing? Or are they worried that these efforts to gain soft power through investing in sports is going to carry on?
I think what has to be understood first is that there is no place whatsoever for criticism in Saudi Arabia now. So there's no freedom of speech. You're in a police state. And so if you don't follow the regime's narrative and ambitions, you basically disappear. So even if someone or some people didn't agree with what was happening with the Saudis wanting to buy a club, they wouldn't say it. So we really can't have a real opinion on what the people in Saudi Arabia think. But what we can see is the people abroad. And basically all, many of the Saudis abroad have been criticizing this decision and wanting it to work, basically. We didn't want this bid to work. We can't really have a negative opinion in Saudi Arabia. At least it won't be published anywhere.
Now, the Crown Prince says that the PIF is a separate entity. It's not connected to Mohammed bin Salman. And they've also, you know, denied that the torture has taken place. Amnesty International have said that at least 10 activists have been reportedly tortured. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's often presented, Lina, as a reformist who has achieved progress in terms of women's rights. And this is sometimes presented as an argument to welcome Saudi Arabia as a partner in order to encourage the reform process. So allowing them to buy Newcastle United or another football club or something else would be a good thing. What do you say in response to that, Lena?
I mean, since MBS came to power, I mean, as the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, there have been changes. That's true. But none of them are structural changes. There are no institutions. Everything is decided top down. And we never know where the decisions come from. And it's really becoming a police state. What's astonishing to see is that mostly all of the positive changes we've seen come with other negative aspects. So, for example, he gave women the right to drive, but he imprisons the very ones who have been campaigning for it. He gives the people the right to go to concerts, but then you have the police that has a new prerogative where they're allowed to detain people based on the public decency law. So basically, if a policeman thinks that a woman dances is not decent enough while dancing, he can arrest her. So there are so many things that are not said to the Western world that people could believe it's opening up, but it's not actually.
Lena, I'm going back, strangely enough, to the football here. Was there also an importance for the Saudi regime, for its own population, to be seen as investing money in an English club? Was that supposed to be something very prestigious? Was it also an operation? Because people talk about soft power internationally, but was it also something which had an importance internally within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Was it shown as a sign of something important happening? Was it reported in such a way, for example?
I don't think so. I mean, what I've been reading and feeling is that it's not something that was intended to have impact within the kingdom. It was mostly to legitimize the crown prince and his policies, to legitimize himself internationally, to be a player in the game, basically. Internally, it would have been, I could have said that it's important, or at least it was aimed at having importance internally. If people would have been, for example, asked or, part of the decision making, or at least, really seeing what their opinion on this is. But it doesn't seem like it's anything made for the people of Saudi Arabia.
Jamal Khashoggi's fiance, Hatice Cengiz, has been outspoken about the takeover. Some of the reaction to that from people who want the takeover to happen is that she in some way is being used by the media who are against the takeover. And it's quite possible that critics listening to us talking now would say the same thing about this, that we're in some way sort of using you to advance an agenda that we potentially have. What would you say to that?
I mean, honestly, of course, my sister is in prison and I have to use every possible way to make her case heard. But it's not only about my sister. I mean, when you have someone ruling a country, a huge country alone in such an authoritarian way, this is the way they handle things in every other topic, and they don't really care about following the rules. So it's not only about us, it's also about, football. If they really want football to be played in a beautiful way, in a way that they respect the rules, I think they shouldn't be so, not ambitious, but so hopeful that this is the right people who should be buying the club.
How does the campaign to get your sister free progress? What can you do? And actually, what can people listening to this who will be very moved by it, what can they do?
I mean, what's important is to say to talk about her, to make sure that she's not forgotten, to make sure she and all the others, actually, all the other activists who are in prison, that she's not forgotten, and that she is in the middle of all the, you know, the decisions made between, your country and Saudi Arabia. Make sure that whenever there's something going on, when your government is going there, when deputies ask questions to ministers, that they make sure that, the relation between Saudi Arabia and the UK is not only about business, but that they make sure that the human rights issue is in the middle of all of this, and that they ask about her and make sure that when they go there, they make sure she is still alive first, because we don't know where she is, and that she will be freed soon.
Thank you so much to Lina Al-Hathloul for chatting to us. I should say here that with regards to the claim that Saud al-Qahtani was present during the alleged torture of Lina's sister, the Saudi public prosecutor has previously said that his office investigated the allegations and concluded that they were false. That is the end of part one. We'll be back in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. For the rest of the podcast, we'll look at whether the Premier League should say something about the Newcastle deal, whether we think it is completely over, but more broadly ask why Gulf nation states want to own football clubs in the first place. Are all their motivations the same? What does soft power actually mean? Does it work? And what power do football fans have in all of this? To do that, we have The Guardian's investigative reporter, David Conn, who's written extensively about all of the above and wrote the book Richer Than God, Manchester City, Modern Football and Growing Up. Hey, David, how are you doing?
Hi, fine, thanks.
And we're joined by James Dorsey, senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, a syndicated columnist, author of the book and the blog The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer, has lived across the Gulf and has covered, as far as I could tell, James, every religious and ethnic conflict of the last 40 years. Thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, I am aware that the three of you know a great deal. We could talk for hours and hours. I want you to treat me like I know nothing. A lot of listeners would agree with that anyway. Now, a lot of our listeners are very literate in all of this stuff, but I think a lot of Football Weekly fans and a lot of football fans follow football to follow football, not necessarily to follow geopolitics. So let's start, I think, with an easy one, James. On the Newcastle takeover, who exactly was making that bid?
It was essentially, in legal terms, a private English investment vehicle. But the bulk of the funds in that vehicle that were being used for the bid for Newcastle United were Saudi public funds. In other words, funds from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. So this was a state investing in a private British legal investment vehicle. But in fact, it would be the state that would have control of the football club.
So is that like the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the United Kingdom buying a stake in an American football team?
Absolutely. So when you make an investment, you can make the investment directly. With other words, you can pay the money into the account of the football club. Or what investors very often do, they create what they call vehicles. And these vehicles are basically single-purpose legal entities, a company of some legal status, that then makes the investment. And the state is in that investment through that vehicle, rather than directly into the football club or whatever other asset they would be acquiring.
And that would be, Max, a similar means that was used for the Qataris for Paris Saint-Germain, which was bought by something called Qatar Sports Investment. And Qatar Sports Investment was set up specifically for this purpose of investing in football and in sports. That was exactly it.
I just want to make the point, this is a standard investment practice. It's not specific to football. It's not specific to sports. It's universal in the investment world that you use these kinds of vehicles.
David, since we've covered who was trying to buy Newcastle and who owns PSG. Who owns Manchester City?
Yeah, it's been really interesting seeing the difference with Newcastle because, as James says, Newcastle was being essentially the takeover was being funded by the public investment fund, which is, you know, literally the state of Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, as they call it, which is, you know, the wealth of the country. And at City, the takeover was in 2008, and they've always really stressed that it wasn't, and even now they stress that it's not a state project, it's not an Abu Dhabi state project, and that it's a private investment by Sheikh Mansour, who is one of the ruling family of Abu Dhabi. You know, obviously I've taken a very, very keen interest in it right from the beginning and had a lot of access to them, interviewed the chairman, Khaldun Al Mubarak, went to Abu Dhabi, you know, to try and understand it right at the beginning. And essentially what happened was, I mean, they still stress it is owned by the vehicle that was set up by Sheikh Mansour. But what happened within days of the takeover was that some very senior political figures in Abu Dhabi, who essentially worked for Sheikh Mansour's brother, the Crown Prince, Sheikh Mohammed, Khaldun Al Mubarak, who is a very, you know, he's like one of his captains, you know, he's very much a senior political and business figure in Abu Dhabi. He and some of the people who worked for him took over the running of the club. And that was very early on in 2008.
So my next question then, James, is why do Gulf states want to buy a football club? And is it the same reason for all of them?
It's fundamentally the same reason for all of them. And the reason is twofold. One is the creation of reputation globally and soft power. And soft power basically means that they are known and there is an empathy with them. So football is a very good vehicle for that because football is the most popular form of popular entertainment in the world. And it's a tribal sport. It evokes enormous passions. So you have an identification that you wouldn't get with the purchase of a grand building, a hotel or whatever in London, for example. And then there's a geopolitical aspect, and that is influence on the international stage, being able, in a sense, to punch in above your weight in the case of many of these countries, like the UAE or like Qatar or like Bahrain. So those are the reasons for it.
James is probably the best place to talk about this, but how different the projects are, because there is always this tendency to think, oh, the Gulf states, you know, as if it were one single entity. And we're talking about very different cases here. And the timetable is different. For example, Qatar started to really get into football in 2004 as part of the Aspire project, but only bought Paris Saint-Germain in 2011 after having bid for the World Cup 2022 in I think February 2009, the Emiratis arrived earlier, so to speak, in the club ownership because it was in 2008. And the Saudis have been very late in it. And it reflects the fact the approach from each of these actors has actually been different. The global aim might be the same, but the means by which they wish to get to that aim are completely different. Like City, for example, it's not just Manchester City, it's the City Football Group, which owns actually 9 clubs on five continents, if you count Central America. So it is rather different, and it is fascinating to find out why exactly they have chosen those different ways.
What's the answer to that, James?
Well, the United Arab Emirates is the most business savvy of all the Gulf states. And in many ways, despite its domestic regime, a lot more forward looking. That goes into the aspect of all of this, which is when you buy a football club, you basically are engaging in two different things. One is diplomacy. And keep in mind that diplomacy has changed. It's no longer foreign ministry guys in pinstripe suits having champagne at a reception. It's public diplomacy. It's reaching out to the public, not just to a government. It's cultural projection. It's sports projection. And the other thing that this does is it gives you access to a whole different group and levels of people that you may not have had otherwise. And it creates other business opportunities. And so what you've seen in the case of the UAE, they have approached this as a business. And if, for example, it has worked phenomenally well for them in China, which is why China has been one of the investors later in Manchester City or in the football group. And so I think that's a very important aspect of why Gulf states are doing this. Saudi Arabia was Johnny come lately to the show, but that has to do with the fact that in 2015, you got a fundamental change in the regime. You had the rise of King Salman and of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
David.
Now, that's really interesting what James is saying about the other opportunities that you get from these ventures and particularly from football. And, you know, we really notice it in England. So when Khaldun Al Mubarak and some of the people who run Manchester City come over to do City business, quite often they have political meetings as well. And you find, you know, they're not very well trumpeted, but then sometimes you just look and you realise that there was an announcement made in Abu Dhabi that they had a meeting with the Foreign Office, or they had a meeting with, you know, ministers to talk about international trade in London. And then you realise that was the same trip that they went to the Etihad and went to again. But also, whenever they come and go to again, they're also having a series of meetings at City. They're checking in on all the different departments, the recruitment of players, the academy. And so you realise that this is, you know, part of the same responsibilities that they've got. And yes, as James was saying, it also opens doors for you all over the world, as City have done it. And they don't necessarily trumpet all that, but it's getting you known all around the world. It's widening your influence all over the world. And, you know, if you've grown up supporting Manchester City as I did, you know, in the 1970s, you know, sometimes you just take a step back and just find it, surreal is the wrong word, but, you know, incredible that this level of global political activity is going on over Manchester City Football Club.
Now, when I tweeted out for questions, and we got a lot of questions, a lot from Manchester City fans, pointing at other ownership of other football clubs. Is there a difference between these three clubs and other foreign investment from owners that we don't necessarily know a lot about? Is there something specifically different about these?
I think so, yeah. I do think that, I mean, obviously we stand to be corrected, and, you know, obviously we'd like to see it if it is the same in other clubs somewhere. But it is a very modern phenomenon that sovereign wealth funds, in effect, you know, given the, you know, the sophistication around the City ownership, but it's still very much an Abu Dhabi project with, you know, the state airline sponsoring the club, the Abu Dhabi Tourism Authority, Visit Abu Dhabi, you know, Abu Dhabi companies sponsoring, and, you know, the people who are involved and the money that's, I mean, more than £1 billion has been poured in to City from Abu Dhabi. Qatar owning PSG, as Philippe was saying, and, you know, Saudi Arabia now late to the party looking to buy clubs. You know, I'm not aware of other countries that are involved to the same extent with owning individual clubs in European competitions.
And I think as well, Max, that we should look beyond ownership, because it's not just the ownership which allows you to have a huge role in sports and to use sports as a means to promote yourself. It's also sponsorship. And some of the most visible sponsors in the world of football, if we stick to football, are airline companies, official state-owned airline companies, which also have been sponsoring major sponsors of FIFA as well. And if you look at the what is written on the shirts of our favorite players, very often you'll see the name of a company which is directly owned by the governments we're talking about. And it's actually quite fascinating to think that, because sometimes the attention that is given to this particular brand of ownership, when we journalists or human rights campaigners talk about it, and very often to criticize it, people say, well, there is, you wouldn't say the same thing if it were not people from the Gulf, if they were not Arabs. That's, you know, a kind of innuendo that there is a kind of xenophobic, if not racist, element to your criticism. Well, the fact is, as David says, I cannot think of any other nation states which have invested in football in that way. Some of them, like Rwanda, for example, will be the sleeve sponsor of Arsenal Football Club. Azerbaijan had at one point a slogan that was Atletico Madrid, land of fire. That's about as far as I can get. It is very interestingly a phenomenon that for the time being, with the exception perhaps of China, which is a different model, which we'll have to look at some point in the future, it is the region from which these state-controlled initiatives emanate from and not from anywhere else.
One really interesting point that's come out when I've been talking to the Abu Dhabi people involved, including the chairman, Khaldun al-Mubarak, and to Qatar, even though they are now, you know, pretty much sworn enemies, they both have the idea that they want to promote a better image of Arab countries and Muslim countries and better understanding. And that's something that they have actually said. And, you know, with obviously it's prompted scrutiny. And therefore, we've looked more closely, or the world has looked more closely at how they treat migrant workers, what the situation is with human rights and political rights and freedom of expression in those countries. They both see themselves as moderate, Abu Dhabi, the UAE and Qatar, in a, you know, very, very difficult region. And it's definitely part of their own projects that they want to promote more understanding of the Arab world through their involvement in football and other, you know, Western cultural activities.
You're listening to the Guardian Football Weekly. We'll finish part two there. Begin part three, talking about human rights. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Philippe Auclair, David Conn, James Dorsey with me. I want to talk about human rights, James. At the start of this pod, we heard some really powerful testimony. And quite often we say, oh, the Middle East, you know, has human rights abuses everywhere. Is it lazy to say it like that? Is there a league table of human rights abuses? Or is it okay to put them all in the same basket?
There are differences, but as a matter of principle, Middle Eastern, but particularly Gulf states, have an awful, abominable human rights record. Now, that's certainly true for Saudi Arabia. It's certainly true for the United Arab Emirates. I would argue that Qatar is slightly better on a number of aspects. Just to give you the latest example, Qatar is the only state in the Gulf, or in fact, to the best of my knowledge, in the Middle East, maybe with the exception of Israel, that has recognized the concept of political asylum. No other state in the Gulf does that. Now, fact of the matter is, Qatar actually has a history of political asylum going back to the late 19th century.
We don't have to talk about league tables of human rights abuses. Terrible things go on all over the world and terrible things go on in our own country. But I think it's valid that if these countries are taking over football clubs for all the different reasons that we've talked about, and they want the magic of football and the passion and the loyalty that people have for their clubs, you know, to reflect well on them and to be, you know, owners that bring success to those clubs. And therefore, you know, there's mutual kind of virtue that's reflected. And, you know, they do get huge, huge publicity for that. And, you know, I wrote in my own book about City's owners that, they are the best owners that Manchester City have ever had, not just with the huge money they've put in, but just in the sophistication and the skill and the intelligence they've brought to it, because they've brought world-class people in all areas to the club. But with that comes a legitimate scrutiny of the country's records, because they're coming to, you know, take over, if you like, something of the essence of our game, of the people's game. And in Qatar, it's actually been really interesting that the focus that there's been on the treatment of migrant workers, so people who come from South Asian countries on terrible money, terrible conditions, away from their families for months and months. You know, human rights campaigners were talking about that issue for years all across the Gulf. And when Qatar won the World Cup and suddenly there was a huge scrutiny on them, they have introduced reforms. They are working with the International Labour Organization to try to make improvements that will be recognised as improvements, you know, in the building of the World Cup. And therefore, my hope is that by raising these issues of human rights abuses and the treatment of migrant workers, we can help to bring about reforms in those countries.
But the other thing they did, and David referred to that briefly, but I want to magnify it because it's much bigger than that. They actually engaged with their critics. So if you're an Amnesty International or a human rights person, if you're going, you will not be able to get on the plane to Abu Dhabi or to Riyadh because your name will be on a blacklist and you will be told you cannot fly. What the Qataris did is they invited Amnesty, they invited the trade unions, they invited Human Rights Watch. And in fact, if you look at the model contract that the Supreme Committee for the organizing of the World Cup developed, that was done in cooperation with these organizations. And that is unprecedented in the Gulf.
The thing is that at the heart of the Qatar involvement in football, there is a huge tension there within the country itself. We should never think that we are talking about monolithic countries. For example, there were people in Qatar who were completely opposed to the idea of bidding for the World Cup and have been really annoyed with it because it has put the spotlight on what is going wrong in the country. And for example, the Doha Chamber of Commerce, for example, there was a huge amount of resistance from them for what was doing. And it's been since then a kind of balancing act, because I've been, you know, Max, I've been one of the people who've been annoying them for a very long time, but they've always tried to engage with me. And I agree with you on this for this, James. But I'm always wondering how much of it is real and how much on it is for the show. Their relationship with trade organizations and workers' union and so forth is extremely ambiguous, and actually maybe something that we should look at in more detail in the future, because some of the alignments are a bit strange, to be honest. Some of the recent things are a bit strange. So it's extraordinarily complex in this area. But one thing I would say for Qatar is that they have, yes, tried to engage.
It's so interesting on this call, we're on a Zoom call, everyone's hand is up all the time. It makes me wonder what I've done with my life to not know anything. I'll go to David next.
That's certainly true about the tension between two different broad factions in Qatari society. And the way that it gets explained to us is that, I mean, the people that we deal with as journalists on, you know, the Qatari World Cup and conditions in Qatar, and when you go to Qatar, the people that you interview, you know, they're young, they're very often educated here. I mean, famously, Hassan Al-Thawadi, who is the chairman of the committee that's delivering the World Cup, did his A-levels in Scunthorpe, and he went to university in Sheffield, you know, and they're American educated, youngish people. I don't think they want their country to be seen as one that oppresses poor people from Bangladesh and Pakistan and elsewhere building, and they want reforms. And the way that it's presented to us is, you know, there's a much more conservative older guard that, as Philippe was saying, is less interested in any of this and like just thinks, why on earth did we ever bid for this silly football thing and start currying favour so much with the West?
Not at all interested, David. Let's be clear about it.
But the fact is that they've had to respond, as James said, because of the level of criticism. And although there is resistance within the country, they genuinely, believe us, we really have looked at this and we've been sceptical and we haven't wanted to be PR'd or soft-soaped. But genuinely, they are working with the International Labour Organization, which is part of the United Nations, to bring in some reforms. Going back to City and Abu Dhabi, you know, with all the praise that City get and the City ownership gets for the success they've brought and the skilled way that they've run the club and the beautiful football they play and the vision that they've had, now, there are serious human rights issues in Abu Dhabi, and Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and other campaign groups have seriously tried to raise them. There's somebody called Ahmed Mansour, who is one of their prisoners of conscience, which means that Amnesty genuinely recognises that they're not pursuing any sort of violent means or, you know, something that can be labelled, you know, violent in any way, and they're genuine human rights campaigners. And he's got a 10-year sentence effectively for, you know, writing and campaigning for better human rights, for some kind of democratic reforms. And it would be so important, I think, for these cases to be given a lot more prominence, because Abu Dhabi itself is given so much prominence through City that some of these prisoners of conscience and the human rights issues that there are there, you know, I really think there should be more focus on them.
Can I move this to Newcastle United? And there are lots of things. And before I go to David about what the Premier League should do and Boris Johnson's intervention, the whataboutery argument that we hear, so Newcastle fans will point to the Saudi Public Investment Fund partly owning Uber, not to mention the UK government's long-standing record of allowing arms sales to the Saudis. Is there any merit to that argument? I can understand why Newcastle fans say, well, if this is all happening, why should the line be drawn when it comes to our football club?
In a sense, they're right. The problem is this. Football clubs are being bought to enhance reputation, to polish tarnished reputation that's been tarnished by abuse of human rights and other practices. So I think there is, you know, on the one hand, there is merit to the argument. With other words, there's a principal question here. How do you deal with countries that are abusive, that go to the length of killing a journalist in their own consulate in the commercial capital of a third country? But you then would have to also draw the line and say, you know, you cannot accept investment in whatever commercial companies. And then you're getting into the whole issue of free market. And to what degree do you want the state intervening in what are purely commercial relationships?
In an email to the Newcastle United Supporters Trust, the Prime Minister said there should be clarity on why there was such a delay in the decision-making process. I appreciate that many Newcastle fans were hoping this takeover bid would go ahead. I can understand their sense of disappointment. I have seen the recent email sent to Newcastle fans from the Independent Football Ombudsman and agree with their conclusion that the Premier League should make a statement on this case. I'm pleased the Ombudsman has committed to advising the Premier League to provide a statement. David, what do you make of Boris Johnson's intervention in the proposed Newcastle takeover and what the Premier League could and should have done or do?
I just think Boris Johnson's intervention was, you know, he just saw which way the wind was blowing. And all the wind in the northeast or Newcastle has been blowing towards criticising the Premier League and surprising a lot of people outside by being so supportive of the takeover. And so Boris Johnson has seen that, for me, he's seen that, you know, there's kind of more in it for him to be seen to be supporting them than to be recognising concerns over the Saudi Arabian takeover, which in the end was delayed and looked like it was going to be blocked because of piracy of TV rights, you know, something very specific. Now, to the question of what can the Premier League do and why should they do anything? Like, we are at peace with Saudi Arabia. We sell arms to Saudi Arabia. They're political allies. They buy into all these other businesses. So that question is really, why should football be any different? But the fact is, not only is football different, it is different. But also, if you love football, then you believe that it should be different. Like, you don't support Uber. You might use Uber, but you don't support them through thick and thin all your life and consider that your identity and your sense of home and your family and some of the greatest memories you've ever got in your life. Well, maybe some of the greatest memories you've ever got in life were actually in the back of an Uber. But you know what I mean? That actually your support for your football club is something very special, and that football, sport embodies certain values. Now, we used to have this argument with the Premier League more than 15 years ago when there was no owners and directors test. There was no fit and proper persons test whatsoever. And I was covering mostly smaller clubs that were being taken over by more like small-time crooks. You know, this idea that countries were going to be taking over on football clubs, we hadn't really thought of that at the time. But it was more like small-time crooks taking over clubs and ruining them. And you would say to the Premier League and the Football League at the time, why don't you have some kind of test that stops, you know, at least convicted criminals taking over and at least make sure that people have got the finances and some kind of plan to take over a club? And they used to make this argument that why should football be any different from business generally? They can take over any company. There's no checks. They used to argue it would be illegal and it would be a restraint of trade for them to have any kind of test at all, right? But in 2004, they gave in on that argument. And they did bring in what was then called a fit and proper persons test. And it does stop people with recent convictions for dishonesty taking over a football club. They do have to show that they've got the money. So in my opinion, what we've got now is a limited, very narrow test that was essentially brought in to stop, as I say, small town crooks taking over small clubs, that is not fit for the modern era where English football is, you know, a vehicle for all the things we're talking about: global reputation, global success, global profit making and diplomacy. They haven't got a kind of philosophical view. What do we want our football clubs to be, and how do we want the ownership, you know, to be organised? That's why in English football, unlike in some other countries, particularly Germany is an example, where the clubs are much more protected from this, and we're open to these kinds of takeovers. And there's still the argument that, well, why should it be different from any other business? But it is recognised to be different.
Question from MCR, who is a Manchester City fan, says, Max, if you and your panel were currently world-class footballers, would your decision to play for City and or PSG be influenced by the ownership of the clubs? And would that apply in your current line of work if City and or PSG approached you to do something for them? I mean, full disclosure, a few years ago, I think I did something for Nike at the Etihad with Toysin Adarabioyo, who plays for City. I did that. And at the time, I didn't question whether I should do that or not. I was offered some money to go and do something. It was an easy afternoon's work. But it's an interesting question for Lee.
It's an interesting question, superficially, artificially. You can perfectly, it's just the same way that you can perfectly write for a right-wing newspaper whom you will abhor for political reasons and be on the sports desk and do a perfectly decent job there. The answer to the question would be, if the job that I was offered, and I'm talking for myself, but I think most of my colleagues would agree with me, if my job involved actually becoming a propagandist for my owner, no, I would never do it, ever. I would always refuse it. This is also one of the reasons why, for example, as journalists, and this is the case with The Guardian, I believe, when you are invited by people who have got an interest in showing you the beauty of their countries, you know, for a football competition, there are two things. Either you refuse to do it and you travel on your own terms, or you do full disclosure. The answer is not yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. It's more subtle than that. When you start becoming a propagandist, this is when you should stop.
But I guess, you know, are City players propagandists by nature of just playing football, right? Are they, or are they two separate things? I don't know the answer.
I think they are separate things up to a point. Pep Guardiola, I would have a different attitude if you were asking me about Pep Guardiola, because Pep Guardiola has made it something which is actually characteristic of him to use his managerial position to make political statements. And he's been, let's say, less than forthright when he's been asked specific questions about his own employers. And so there would be a difference, because he basically took it on himself to make a political statement. When it comes to being an employee of the club, you could regret the fact that, you know, somebody you love as a player is playing for a club that you don't like very much. I wouldn't cast a stone at them for that, even if I know it becomes a bit of an ambiguous area. I mean, actually, you're making me think here, Max, which is good.
First time for anything, right?
Because there are no easy answer to that. I genuinely think there is a red line which is there, not a line in the sand. There is a red line. When you become a propagandist, that's where the problem starts.
Yeah, you know, I think that you could make the argument, but that would be the most consequential argument to make, that if you are playing for a club and that club is successful, then you're contributing to the reputation enhancement. Now, to be fair, there's a big difference between a football player and a journalist. What constitutes the integrity of a football player and how that relates to him professionally, and what constitutes the integrity of a journalist, are two different things. And so I think that you also have to be very, very conscious of those differences, of what moral standards you professionally need to live up to.
Yeah, I think it is a really interesting question, and it does make us think. There is a little bit more that players can do and that managers can do to use their platforms. And we've seen it obviously most celebrated way this summer with Marcus Rashford, you know, raising a social issue of poverty in our country and immediately having an effect on government policy. And so, you know, the general culture of players is still, it's a short career and we want to maximize our earnings absolutely from the years that we can play at the top level. Plus, we want to be at a club that's going to be successful. That's basically a player's, you know, the culture of professional footballers. And, you know, I don't think anybody's calling for them to be speaking out every 5 minutes on different issues. You know, Pep, for example, when he wore his yellow ribbon to highlight the political situation in Catalonia, but when he was asked, well, what about human rights in Abu Dhabi and the United Arab Emirates, gave a bit of a garbled response. But rather than criticise Pep for that, I'm thinking about that now and thinking, but if only Pep had taken that step and used his platform there to say, yes, I am concerned about all human rights, including, you know, I love working for this club, I love working for these owners, but including in their country, how much of a voice and a platform do these people have? So as athletes, you know, obviously more in the US than anywhere else, use their platform for human rights, anti-racism statements, then yes, actually, it would be something really progressive to see them speak out on human rights issues, you know, when it's opportune for them to do it.
What about fans? At the start of this podcast, we heard from Lena, who said fans have more power than they know. Do they, James?
I think that's, on the one hand, I think that's true. But that then goes to a much broader question, which is political engagement by the public, political awareness by the public, which often in democracies we find, you know, you look at elections, voters are apathetic very often. I think that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, but David probably can, and maybe Philippe can speak to this much more, and that is when you get clubs whose fan base is global and in which the local fan base probably is a minority, then the question of how you mobilize a fan base like that becomes a much more difficult question. So I think you've also got to look at this on a club-by-club basis in terms of what the power of the fans are.
The way the fans react is varies wildly from one club to the next. You can sometimes, when you see, for example, Bayern has got very, very close links with Qatar. And Mr. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge has very close links with Qatar. The Bayern ultras haven't wasted one occasion to make it up to be known to everybody, including to the general viewing public around the world, that they opposed and very fiercely those links. They've been putting banners in the stadium which have been picked up by cameras, shown all around the world where Bundesliga matches are being shown. And this, I think, is a rather imaginative way of looking at it. And which, by the way, some Newcastle fans, if not the trust, have taken in exchanges that we've had with them, certainly I've had with them, saying, well, we would welcome a new owner, but we wouldn't mind St. James Park becoming a place where you could actually say what you think about this owner. We actually already say it about Mike Ashley. Go out. Why couldn't we, if we have people that we object to in terms of their behavior, well, we'll just let it be known in the stadium. So it's possible to have that. So it varies from one club to the next, from one league to the next, from one football culture to the next, and sometimes within a single football culture.
Oh, well, listen, chaps, it's been fascinating. I know we could do another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, but most people's commutes or cycle rides are about an hour long. So that's ideally how long we make a podcast. But thanks so much for your time today, James. Thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
David, thank you, mate.
Thanks a lot, Max.
Philippe, as always, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.